position number 21297, reel 1.
Mr. Nash, reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Malaga, in Spain.
Which year was this?
1920.
Were both your parents English?
My mother wouldn't like that. She was an Irish woman.
So why?
My father was English.
Why Malaga?
Well, my father, after the First World War, my father wanted to find somewhere where he could speak Spanish, because he'd been in the Argentine before the war. And that was too far for my mother, the Argentine. So they settled on Spain itself. And he was the shipping manager for MacAndrews shipping line.
Did you grow up and have your education in Spain?
No, not at all. I left Spain when I was still one or two, perhaps. I came back to England with my parents.
So where did you grow up?
Mostly in Epsom.
And your schooling?
I was at Epsom College.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
17.
Just before the war started?
Yes, that's right.
Did you get a job on leaving school?
I became an article clerk to a firm of accountants, which I disliked very much. And I was very glad of the war to escape from it.
Were you working in London? Or
in London.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I don't think I did. I can't remember, to be honest.
What was your reaction to the news that war had been declared?
Well, I had thought for a couple of years that it was inevitable. So it wasn't a complete surprise. I think most of my age group were, in the year before the war, were resigned to the fact that there was going to be a war, and they were going to be in it.
Did the war affect you at first?
Not really. As I say, I escaped from my chartered accountancy.
Were you in any bombing by the German Air Force?
No. I was, when I joined the army, I was posted up to Yorkshire. I was on the Yorkshire coast for 1940. So, and there was very little activity there. My friends and family in the south had been bombed by then.
Do you remember roughly when you joined?
Maybe August 40. I joined up about the time of the Battle of Britain. Don't remember exactly, to be honest.
Once you joined, what was the procedure?
Well, it was an interesting one. I wanted to be a gunner because my father had been a gunner. And I tried to volunteer for the Royal Artillery, but they saw my spectacles and said that they couldn't have a field gunner with spectacles, so I could be an anti-aircraft gunner. And I didn't like the sound of that at all. It was sitting on gun sites around London indefinitely. So I decided I'd try for signals. So I saw myself as a dashing dispatch rider carrying the important news around the world. But it wasn't to be, because the army, in its wisdom, had discovered that musicians made very good wireless operators. And they worked from there. Anybody who had any knowledge of music, they decided must become a signalman. And it was interesting, but it wasn't for me. It wasn't what I wanted to do. And when I was finally selected to go to a cadet institution, I was able to volunteer for artillery. Now, as an officer, they didn't mind me wearing spectacles, as a gunner, I had objected. Odd, it's an odd arrangement. Anyway, from there I became a gunner eventually. I was commissioned in the Royal Regiment. I was very fortunate because my group, about 1,200 of us, were selected for training in India. And we were treated by the School of Artillery, we were treated as gentlemen cadets, which was not a cut above the treatment that the cadets received in this country. And ironically, I was posted, when I was commissioned, I was posted to a light anti-aircraft regiment on the grounds that I knew something about aeroplanes and nobody else did. And really I took it from there. I stayed in anti-aircraft, light anti-aircraft for the rest of the war.
When you were on the Yorkshire coast, this was coastal defence during the crisis.
Yes.
Any memories from that?
Yes, being addressed by our brigadier, that we had old Italian rifles and 5 rounds of ammunition apiece, and our job was to hold up the Germans if they arrived on the beach long enough for the Central Reserve to get there, which seemed rather final to us.
Which part of Yorkshire was this?
Whitby, the area of Whitby.
Did you personally expect the Germans to land?
No, not on that coast. Didn't seem to me likely in the least. And it seemed almost certain they'd have to go across the shortest distance.
And where did you do most of your training?
In Deir Ali, the School of Artillery. It was an 8-month course, which was rather longer than usual.
What did it consist of?
It consisted of training in field artillery, oddly enough, more than and some light anti-aircraft work. But I was trained as a field gunner, basically, which meant learning to serve the gun and calculate all the calculations necessary to put a shell in the right place.
What did you think of the quality of the training you got there?
Excellent, excellent. The instructors all knew their job, and we worked very hard. But you felt a sense of achievement at every step forward.
Had the Japanese war broken out by then?
No. This was I can give you dates.
Don't worry about
this. From my file, if you want them. But no, the. Eventually, I was commissioned in August. My battery was formed in, the battery I went to was formed in September. And we got our first recruits in October. This is 41. And when the battery was fully manned, the average age was 18. And the only experienced soldiers of any sort were the NCOs. So you can describe it as an absolutely raw battery. And the officers were mostly in the state that I was, still learning enough Urdu to command the troops. But I saw my battery commander say that he'd protested about our being sent overseas from India, but he was told there was no one else. And we were warned originally for Singapore. But one battery of the regiment went to Singapore. But we went to Burma. My battery went to Burma.
Can you give me the full title of the unit you belong to, please?
Yes. It was 3 battery. Sorry, I'm getting the order wrong. The regiment was the 1st Indian Light Anti-Aircraft Regiment. And the battery was the 3rd battery of the regiment.
And what was your role with the battery?
I was a troop leader. Troop commander. I commanded a troop of 4 guns.
Did the troop have a number or name?
It would be B troop.
And what rank would you have held then?
I was a second lieutenant.
What kind of duties were you expected to carry out in that role?
Training the men. It was the in gun drill and in firing and general discipline.
What were the men like?
My battery was all Punjabi Muslim, good, stolid countrymen, excellent soldiers. They lacked the elan of the Sikhs, but they were completely reliable in all circumstances. And the Sikhs, I'm afraid, preferred to be on the winning side to show their dash. But there, I have acquired the prejudice of my Punjabi Muslim soldiers who didn't like Sikhs.
Did it cause any problems in the unit?
No. The second battery of the regiment was a Punjabi Brahmin battery. And I remember as orderly officer, the first time I went round the cookhouse, there was a great uproar because my shadow had fallen on the chapatis, and therefore, they were, to Brahmins, they were unclean. And I was a bit nervous about this, so I went off to see my colonel. Oh, he said, they always try it on new officers. Go back and tell them that unless they eat their chapatis, they'll starve. So I did, and they did.
What happened next?
Well, in December we were sent to Calcutta as part of the defences there, and at the end of December we went to Burma.
Any details about being in Calcutta?
Not really. We continued training, of course. We needed to.
Was there any sign of civil disturbance in Calcutta?
Yes, they'd started on the so-called peaceful movement against British rule, and I'm confusing this to some extent. There wasn't a great deal. It was uneasy, but there wasn't a great deal of disturbance. That came later. We had quite a time of getting out. We had to load the ship ourselves in Calcutta docks when we went to Burma, because the stevedores had all disappeared. I'm trying to remember whether there'd been any bombs dropped at that stage. Before we left, I don't think so.
Had they disappeared from fear or from political reasons?
Yes, from fear. So there may well have been a raid at that stage, which I don't remember. We certainly weren't engaged in the action there.
Can you tell me about the voyage from Calcutta, please?
Yes, it was interesting in a way. When we got on board, we wanted to put our guns in positions on the ship, in positions where they could fire. But the captain insisted that no guns were to be forward of the bridge, because that would be offensive armament, and he would be liable to penalties if the ship was captured. Which I thought was an interesting move. I don't think it would have counted for much later in the war, but we had to observe it. The ship we went on was a free French ship. They were lonely souls. They'd been cut off from their families, of course, for a year or so by that time. And when we got to Rangoon, the place was a shambles. They'd been pasted again and again down in the docks. And the smell of rotting bodies was very unpleasant. But we didn't stay in Rangoon. We were posted to an aerodrome outside. And the sea troop went down to Moulmein. A troop stayed in the dock area of Rangoon. But that was 12 guns altogether. It's a drop in the ocean, really. And then we didn't do much firing from around the airfield because the RAF required us to keep quiet, keep away from their aircraft, which were doing the work, they said. But the RAF had, at that time, there was a squadron of Brewster Buffaloes, which were hopeless aircraft. And it was, we had a detachment of Hurricanes came in a little later. And then they began to do some real work. Most of the work was done by the AVG, the American Volunteer Group.
What do you remember happening next?
The next stage was the Japanese started to cross into Burma, across the mountain hill ranges into Burma, and my troop was sent down to the Satang Bridge, which was a major bridge on the railway from Rangoon to Pegu and Mataban. And that became, there was some very heavy fighting at that stage because the Japanese were trying to cut off 17 Division from the bridge. And we were fighting to keep the bridge going. It was interesting, the bridge had been originally had been a railway bridge only, and the sappers planked it to take road traffic. I remember seeing an ambulance train trundling back from it had been down the main side, which struck me as a rather odd. I don't know what happened to it. But the fighting became very, very, very ugly. And on the Japanese side, well, the, I think the east side of the bridge. One of my guns, which was very exposed to snipers, I had to change its position and bring it back behind the bridge. We managed to do that, although we were very heavily sniped, very unpleasant. And then there wasn't much enemy activity. I was surprised. Presumably they were saving the bridge for themselves because they didn't attack it from the air. To speak of. We moved the guns to our side of the river. We built up a gun pit with sleepers for one position. And a stray bullet came through the crack between two of the railway sleepers that we used, hit a box of ammunition, and it was extraordinary. The box exploded, as it seemed to me, but I was in the gun pit with two men. None of us were hurt. But when the smoke cleared away, there were the shells sitting in the box. The end had blown out, the cartridges had gone. They'd move because they're lighter in gravity than the shells. And there were all the shells left behind. Extraordinary. And we were untouched, but two Sikh gunners outside our gun pit were hit by the shells and died. It's the most extraordinary accident. Then the next stage that I was involved in, the animal transport, the pair mule, two-wheel carts, started trundling across the bridge. And every now and again, a mule would see through a wider gap between the sleepers that the sappers had put down as a track. And they would, any number of them, well, I say any number, must certainly, the best part of a dozen, in Shying fell off the bridge themselves, and there was the cart across the bridge with the two mules dangling from the girder, even further out. And a group of us were cutting the mules free. They fell into the river. I don't know what happened to them. We didn't care. But we could chuck the carts over as well and clear the bridge. And while we were doing this, the sappers were laying the charges on the bridge, and we were all being sniped fairly merrily. So it was a pretty lively time. The battle quietened down that evening, and in the morning I'd had some sleep. As I had a cup of tea, I heard a hell of a bang, which told me that they'd blown the bridge. As a mere second lieutenant, it was my opinion that they blew the bridge too soon. They had left the whole of one brigade and half a brigade the other, the wrong side of the river. But, well, who knows? It wasn't my decision. But I don't think it was a good one. And the divisional commander was relieved later on, so it seems that he made the wrong decision too. It was considered that he made the wrong decision. And then we withdrew, the polite word, to Pegu, which was a major road junction. And we stayed in Pegu for quite a time.
When you had the guns on the east side of the Satang River,
yes,
were you doing much firing against the enemy?
No, very little. We weren't very well placed to do any ground firing, and there was very little attack on the part of the Japanese Air Force. I think they were preserving the bridge for themselves, so they didn't want to knock it out.
What did the morale of your troops seem to be like?
Good, good. They had been pretty exasperated when we weren't allowed to fire on the aerodrome, when we were on the aerodrome near Rangoon, and they put out that they hadn't got much to do at this stage. But several of them were using their rifles against what they thought were snipers. So I think I would say the general attitude was good.
Was your troop called Four Troop or D Troop?
My troop was B Troop, B for Bear.
So you were then at Pegu?
Pegu, yes. Now, the Pegu, we had a lot of firing. For some reason, the Japs bombed us regularly. I remember one particular incident. They bombed us. They were very, very Teutonic in their methods. You could predict what they were going to do. They bombed us 4 days running. And each time they made a dummy run and bombed us on the return. And the fifth occasion, when there was a major raid, I was walking across the bridge that we were protecting then, in as casual a way as I could. And I saw something flickering in the sunlight. I thought, oh, there's the raid. Put my field glasses up to see. And it wasn't the aircraft, it was a salvo of bombs on its way down to the bridge. And I said to my Jemadar sergeant, "Sir, run like hell!" And we ran like hell for the end of the bridge that we'd started out from, we were closer. Just as well we did, because the other end of the bridge had a direct hit.
You shouted in English?
Yes, yes. Well, that's another story. But he understood English all right.
What's the story about his knowing English?
Well, my troop commander, by this time the troop had been taken over by a more senior man, but he was killed at Pegu, and I was left with the troop to command. And, well, my order was pretty limited at that stage, but we got by. About a year later, I was standing by the roadside with my Jemadar Saab, Viceroy's commissioned officer, and a British officer came, British service officer came up, and my Jemadar Saab, to my astonishment, replied to him in perfect English and gave him instructions in perfect English. And I could hardly contain myself until the other chap had gone. Then I turned on the Jemadar Saab, Alam Shah, his name. And I said, "Saab, you speak English?" He said, "Indeed I do, Saab. I've got a first-class interpreter standing in English." But I said, when Griffith Saab was killed, you didn't tell me that you spoke English?" "Ah," he said, "Saab, if I had, you wouldn't have learned Punjabi."
Punjabi or Urdu?
Urdu. Well, officially Urdu, but in fact, most of my troops spoke Punjabi.
What happened next?
Well, there was a roadblock. The Japanese established a roadblock at Pego, which had to be broken, and there was a lot of ill-organized firing of one sort or another. One morning there was a mist, and when the mist rose, we saw a Japanese company of Japanese infantry formed up, ready to attack, and we took them on with the two Bofors we'd got there, and demolished them very effectively. In fact, I had to stop the gun detachments because they'd changed to single shot to finish off the survivors. And it wasn't worthwhile expending that ammunition, which was precious. But I think that shows the attitude of the men. And one of my guns, well, it's a longish story, but one of the guns had been overrun by the Japanese, and that was when Brian Griffiths was killed. And I had to do something about just carrying it. We couldn't move it. It had punctured tires. And I only had one small vehicle. So I had to do what I could to disable it. So eventually I put a round in the down the spout and wedged it in the rifling and fired the gun. And there was a hell of a bang. And apparently nothing had happened. Even the flame guard was there. But I had a look, and the rifling had been torn at the muzzle. And so all was well. But the interesting thing was to me that the safety device in the fuse had worked, and that because it only activated after the shell had left the muzzle, and the round that I fired hit the one in the flame guard end and simply disappeared, but it didn't explode. And in some extraordinary way this got back to ordnance, and they sent him in North Assam. They sent somebody up from Delhi to North Assam, an ordnance man, who wanted to know what the lot number of the ammunition was that I had fired, because they wanted to tell the people who'd made the ammunition how well the ammunition had stood up. The fuse had worked, the fuse hadn't blown, and all the safety precautions were good, to encourage them. I'm afraid I wasn't able to give them the lot number. What then? And then we went further east, where the junction, the road, two roads parted, one that went up the Pegu Valley, Pegu up the Tongu, and the other up to the Prome, towards Prome. At that stage, coming out of Rangoon, A troop, which was another troop of the battery, had lost a gun on the road. Driver swerved to avoid something, and the gun turned over, and the tractor turned over. And they had left it there and beat it north to the main concentration where we were. And my battery commander, Charles McFetridge, sent me back to see if I could collect the gun. Well, it wasn't my gun, I wasn't best pleased about it, but an order's an order, so off I went. It was very, very unpleasant. We were at least 6 miles away from the nearest British troops at this stage where the gun was, and the Japanese were filtering across, and we saw two parties of Japanese filtering across.